Assalamu alaikum. This is episode 32, Reclaiming Iraqi Narratives with independent freelance journalist, filmmaker, and photographer, Ahmed Twedge.
When you say the word Iraq to someone, the first thing that pops into your mind is a war zone, car bombs, terrorism, ISIS, all those like negative connotations suddenly jump into your mind. As being someone from the diaspora and going to Iraq to visit it, you kind of see actually it's not that. There are people living an amazing lifestyle or enjoying their life and having fun and enjoying some of the stuff that we enjoy. So it became more of a let me change the narrative.
Ahmed Twedge is an independent freelance journalist. His work has been published in numerous outlets including The Independent, The Guardian, New York Times, Vice, BBC and many more. His work focuses on US politics, social justice issues and the Middle East. He zealously tells stories as a means to promote equality, as well as holding those in power to account. His work has taken him across the US, UK, Europe, and the Middle East. Ahmed is also a manager of Everyday Iraq, an online social media platform dedicated to shedding light on the daily life of Iraqis and providing a new narrative for the nation. The project has been featured by numerous international outlets, including the BBC and Metro. We'll be speaking to Ahmed about his journey, his ventures into journalism and filmmaking, and reclaiming Iraqi narratives. Before we begin, we wanted to give a shout out to our friends over at Immigrantly. Are you tired of clickbait headlines about immigrants and people of color? Introduce some nuance into your life with Immigrantly, a weekly podcast hosted by Sadia Khan that deconstructs tired stereotypes about what it means to be an immigrant, a child of immigrants, a person of color, and everything in between. Described by CNN Style as illuminating the US immigrant experience, each episode offers a fresh perspective on topics from statelessness to dating as a child of immigrants. The conversations are complex, challenging, and sometimes messy, but never one-dimensional. Subscribe to Immigrantly wherever you listen to podcasts and find Immigrantly on Twitter at @Immigrantly_pod, Facebook and Instagram at @Immigrantly_pod. Ahmed, assalamu alaikum. How are you doing?
Wa alaikum salam, I'm good, how are you?
Good, thank you, good to see you after a long 2 weeks. I don't know how you've been bearing my absence these past 2 weeks. How's California treating you?
I don't know how I sleep at night, I've been struggling to be honest.
I'm also missing you
too much.
I'm also really, both of us are feeling out of place because you got the show mic there with you, making us look bad. And I don't want to edit this together, your audio is going to sound the best. So you know, feeling really... basking in your greatness right now. So how's everything going with you?
Yeah, well, you were with me when I bought the mic, so you could have actually bought it yourself.
I know.
Instead of just browsing the photos, you went to the store today as well, and he just looked at it and just was just like, "Wow, it's so cute."
It's just that massive cost, but hopefully one day, you know, I'll give in. Hopefully the next 2 weeks or so, I'll give in and buy the show mic. Hasnain's already going to buy a Blue Yeti. So we're gonna go for it, inshallah, so it should be fun. I guess just to start off, firstly, thank you so much for joining us. We've been friends for quite a long time, and you've been doing some fantastic work in various different fields. You know, you're very multifaceted, multi-talented, and I can't wait to get into the hows and whys of what you do. I guess just to start off, I think what's interesting is that, you know, you kind of dived into journalism without having, you know, really, from what I understand, studied it at all. You kind of garnered a fascination with it. So I guess, where did that come from? Where did your kind of like drive to jump into journalism come from? When did it start?
I think I've always had the drive to have some sort of storytelling. And I think really, like, deep down, there's been this passion about having... being able to get the stories that are unheard, where people are suffering around the world and issues are going on around the world. And when we kind of feel trapped as to not being able to make a difference, and I just feel like that we all should be having a voice to be able to like help the stuff that's going on around. And I used to look up to people like Mehdi Hassan and or even Owen Jones back in the day, like the amount of achievement that these guys were doing when I was still in university was just like a phenomenal experience that I really wanted to try to like implement something like that. And I remember I was reading a quote by Arundhati Roy, who's a famous Indian author. If you guys haven't read her stuff, she wrote A God of Small Things. And she wrote a line along the lines of, there's no such thing as the voiceless, and it's just the conveniently unheard. And that kind of really resonated with me. Because it's true, like there's people who are suffering, and it's not that they don't have a voice or they're not telling us, we're just choosing not to listen. So an example that I give people here out in LA at the moment is the homelessness crisis. Like, you walk the streets and you see these tents everywhere, people living in tents. And it's not that these guys don't have a voice, that they're not struggling. You're seeing that as you walk into your coffee shop buying your $20 cappuccino, you're seeing those tents. So it kind of felt like a responsibility that we have to like share these stories and hopefully make some sort of change. And a lot of people used to think it's like grassroots levels or go into politics or do this or do that. And I like, if we just look at how someone like Donald Trump rose to power, it was through the media. Like, it's say something right. inflammatory, get make something go viral, get people talking about it, and it hopefully it can make a change.
Got it. So I want to just ponder on the self-taught journalism part.
Yeah.
Because I connect with you on that because I've been acting for about 8 years, but I'm kind of a self-taught filmmaker because I've learned like screenwriting through my journey as an actor, and I learned like production through my journey as an actor. Do you find it difficult in regards to being a self-taught journalist when you clash, if any, with journalists who actually went to school and studied and did the whole nine for it? Because from my end as a filmmaker, sometimes I don't get the proper respect with my fellow peers that are filmmakers who like went to school and sacrificed everything for it. And now they're competing with somebody who kind of just, you know, studied finance and then came into filmmaking on his own. Any difficulties there? And what, you know, how was your journey like that from the shift? Because I know you were a medical doctor, then shifted into journalism yeah. as you travel the world.
So I think with anything, I believe that everything can be self-taught. Like, you can teach yourself how to do right. things. Like, I've gone into video having not learned anything. I've learned how to like edit videos and make videos and things like that. And I've like ended up like being nominated and winning awards for them. So I don't think it's an issue of the self-taught thing, especially when it comes to something like journalism, because I personally don't believe it's one of those degrees that you need to study. And a lot of the most famous journalists haven't actually studied journalism per se. There's like one or two schools which are renowned for their journalism, and that Columbia University, for example, is one of them. Their school of journalism is like world renowned for bringing out the best people. But really, when I ask people who study there, they say like the most beneficial thing for them is the networking that it provides, the opportunities, and that is an important thing. But when it comes to actually being able to tell a story, for me, somebody who goes to Iraq and tells a story of Iraq, I would rather they understand Iraq as opposed to understand just like a small concept of journalism, because then you end up with these journalists that show up all around the world who think Iraq is just the dichotomy of Sunni versus Shia, which it isn't, as in it's a far more complicated issue. So yeah, and then when it comes to like the filmmaking stuff, it's like I can see why people might say those things to you, or you might feel that way, but I think it's important that we believe in ourselves, that we can like pick up books and study and read. Malcolm X famously said, "My alma mater was the library." So he didn't actually go to university and studied. He was sat in the library and read those books and learned himself. Ken Burns, one of the most famous documentary filmmakers, he didn't study film per se. He just said, "I picked up a camera and decided to try and make films." So I do think that, and then at the end of the day, like, let's say you start making a film and it's a terrible film. I'm sure it isn't, but let's say it is. That's still a learning process. Your next, you're going to be like, okay, this is where I went wrong. The next one is going to be like this and that. Having said all of that, like, and to be brutally honest with you, I do suffer from massive imposter syndrome. Like, it, half the time I'm like, who am I? I'm just like some guy from London who graduated medical school and who's going to ever take me seriously compared to some of these more phenomenal people out there. And I guess in a way that just trains you to work harder. So whenever I submit an article or a piece or a video or whatever it is, I go over it about 200 million times before I actually end up submitting it, just to make sure that I've got it right.
You know, one thing that was interesting what you mentioned was that, you know, for you, storytelling is almost a way to shed light on people suffering, right? And I think one thing you mentioned, which was so interesting, is that, especially in California, and Hassan, I'll tell you, like when I was there with you, Ahmed, the homelessness crisis there is unbelievable. Like, it's just like refugee. It's literally like a refugee camp. Like, everywhere you look, there's homeless people in front of you. They're in tents.
Worse than here?
Worse than here. Yeah, it's just so unbelievable. And I think one thing that really, my first reaction was, what's going on? How can we help? What can we do? How can we, like, help these people? Like, literally help these people. And I think what's interesting is that with some people, with many people, it becomes, they're so accustomed to walking past issues like the homelessness crisis or other crises, other problems that are in your face. But there's only a handful of us, I feel, that really look at these issues and be like, you know what, I want to help these people. I want to tell stories to kind of like assist them. So I guess what I'm asking is, what inspires you? What is that spark that you have specifically that speaks to you and says, you know what, I want to do something to help people that are less fortunate than me? Where does that come from?
I think it comes definitely from a place of privilege, being able to grow up in a stable household and a stable lifestyle. It's just the issue that you look around you and you know that these problems are solvable. You know that it's come from a place of greed. You know that it's just people who, through no fault of their own, have gone through a struggle. And I guess for me, it's just become an important. That's where the spark really comes from. It's because they have no role in that. It's not their fault that they have to work three jobs and still live homeless. It's not their fault that the wages that they get when they work in these big multinational companies doesn't afford the rent to live in a place like California. So it's these things that really make me feel like, yeah, you know what, this is something that we can make a change. And I don't think it has to be like, this is the thing, like for me, that when I've grown, I don't think it has to be like the literal story of an individual person. That's a true story in journalism. I do believe now, for me, that's where I've shifted, that media and narratives and all that stuff can actually make a real achievement. So at the end of the day, it's all about trying to hold these people in power. And I don't just mean the presidents and the prime ministers. I also mean the CEOs of the big companies to account. That's the real crux of what we're trying to get at.
Profound. I want to move on to Everyday Iraq, which is a fantastic Instagram page, which essentially shows Everyday Iraq. Fantastic stuff. So you are, I believe, a curator of the Instagram account. Can you just walk me through, I guess, what the Instagram account is for those who haven't maybe heard of it and how you kind of got involved?
Yeah, so it's a community based platform where it was created in like 2012-ish, 2013. And that's basically when I jumped on board as well, by a guy called Ahmed Musa, who's a brilliant photographer. He's currently based in Beirut, but from Iraq originally. And the idea is to showcase daily Iraqi lifestyle. And I'm sure, like, when I tell people, when you say the word Iraq to someone, the first thing that pops into your mind is a war zone, car bombs, terrorism, ISIS, all those like negative connotations suddenly jump into your mind. And I think, especially going as being someone from the diaspora and going to Iraq to visit it, you kind of see, actually, it's not that. There are people living an amazing lifestyle or enjoying their life and having fun and enjoying some of the stuff that we enjoy. So it became more of a, let me change the narrative. Let me like grab hold of the narrative that's kind of focused on Iraq, and let me take it into my own place. So that was kind of where it came from. The idea is that people they take photos of what's happening in Iraq, and they upload it to Instagram. They use the hashtag Everyday Iraq if they want it to be featured on the page. And we promote it, and it can be anything. And it's from all over the country, including like the Kurdish region, from the south, from Baghdad to Najaf, Karbala. So it's to try showcase as much of Iraq as we can and the demographics and the different ethnicities. And the feedback has been excellent from it.
Yeah. It's interesting because when I pondered on the page, it was phenomenal. I recently just came back from Iraq myself, and it's like when I was telling like my coworkers or people like, hey, I'm going to be going overseas. Where exactly are you going? Iraq. They're like, oh my god, like they have this image in their head, and you know, when I tell them like, yeah, like despite what happened there, and despite the living standards there, people are actually really happy there. I recently was there, and like people were just happy. People were on the streets. I was eating food from outside when everybody tells you never to eat food from outside. I had grilled fish. It was a really good time. It was a really, really good time. And I think that, you know, when I came on that page, you know, it brought back those memories. You know, this is my fourth time going to Iraq, and it's just like, yeah, it's just, it's like a really beautiful country, and it's unfortunate, but you know, it, again, like that page and yourself, and even myself, when I share pictures with my colleagues or whatnot, you know, changing that image, not just of Iraq, but many countries that fall under that you know, that image of like, oh my God, you're going there. So I was really happy to see that page.
You know what's really funny actually, is that I know I met someone in Najaf once, and I was like, oh, I'm going to Baghdad next week. And they're like, oh my God, you're going to Baghdad. They had this image, oh, Baghdad, that's the place where the car bombs are, right? So yeah. even within Iraq, you've got that kind of false narrative going on as well. And it's understandable. Like Iraq, when I speak to Iraqis, they're like, oh, no way you can go to Damascus. Like, that place is where a war zone is, correct? Yeah. And then you look at the actual, what people are doing in Damascus. They're having great feasts, they're having food and things. I'm not saying it's a safe place. I'm just saying that the narrative of pure war isn't accurate. And so that's really the case in Iraq. The last time there was a significant car bomb in Baghdad, there was a couple in January, but before that there wasn't one for 3 years.
Yeah.
And the same thing in the south of Iraq, there hasn't been a car bomb in Najaf for, I can't even remember the last one.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is that when we kind of especially people here in America, Iraq becomes, you know, whenever you hear a news story of a bombing or something happening in Iraq or any conversation in the news that surrounds Iraq, in your mind, subconsciously, you reduce Iraqi people to numbers, to figures. 8 people died, 10 people died, 12 people died. This many widows, this many orphans, this many people are hungry, this many people are jobless. It's always numbers. It's never this many people are protesting. So I think one thing I really like about the Instagram page is that you're no longer seeing Iraqis or I guess any sort of demographic as a number, as data. You're seeing them as real people who aren't a monolith, right? You have so many different types of peoples and experiences in Iraq, just like you do any other country. You know, no one person is like the other. Everyone's got different perspectives and different opinions and different ways of living. And I think that's one of the things that I like a lot about the page, and just generally a lot of the work that you do is really just uncovering these different really cool perspectives and people who live and stories that take place in Iraq, which I think is really interesting. Why do you think it's important to, I guess, humanize or normalize the Iraqi experience?
Yeah, so that's a really important question, I think. So the primary issue here that we're talking about is that as soon as you dehumanize any human beings and you are basically making them a target for potential genocide in the future, when someone is less than human, it makes killing them a lot easier. It makes the decision to go to war a lot easier. You know, if somebody attacks a white American blonde woman, it becomes huge headline news in the US. Whereas if it was a brown colored kid somewhere, you're going to hear less about it. And you can go through like a lot of history as well when you talk about that. Like, look at how David Cameron referred to the refugee crisis, the people trying to cross the channel into the UK from France. He called them a swarm, and what swarms are like bees and things like that. So it makes them dying a lot easier to kind of swallow than if you're saying this is somebody's brother or sister. And that's where like journalism came in. What really changed that the perception in terms of the refugee crisis was that picture of that child on the shores of Greece. I forget his name. I think it's Ayan Kursi. That photo of that child is what really changed people's perception. Suddenly everyone's wording of refugees and crisis and migrants and economic, it all changed to, you know, let's try help these people. And I actually remember meeting you there on
right, we went to so it's funny because we've known each other for maybe 10 years now, but we've every so often we just kind of randomly bump into each other. So we met in where did we go? It was Hungary, right? Budapest, I think. Not Budapest, sorry, Hungary, the Hungary Serbian border.
We went through Budapest,
right? Yeah, met Budapest, and we were there, and you were doing work, you were delivering I want to say aid to the refugees. And
yeah, it was like food and clothes, and it was all like donations from London, and we drove from London all the way over.
Even that, for me, that experience, like just seeing people in person, like it's funny because even if you haven't, I guess, you know, purposely dehumanized them in your head, whenever you're reading about them or watching news, it's still like text on paper, or it's like visuals on screen, right? It's just, it's not real per se, but when you're there in the middle of it and you meet people and you realize, I'll never forget, there was one, we were doing some filming, and there was one family we met, which was a Syrian family who had basically come over from Syria, and the guy was like, "Hey, come film my baby," and he had this amazingly cute baby, maybe like 6 months or 7 months old, with, I'll never forget this, with the bluest eyes. Yeah. And we were interviewing him, and I just kind of walked away, and I literally broke down because the innocence in that baby was absolutely unbelievable. I'm just imagining that this baby has gone through war and has traveled through, you know, across the borders, through seeing death and been on boats over, you know, toward Greece, etc. Like, just seeing that in person really kind of, you know, changed my perspectives and kind of teaches you that, hey, this could have been you in another life, another world. It still can be you, right? And I think that's where the kind of like humanization of these people who are suffering kind of comes in. Hasnain, do you want to jump in? Or?
Yeah, I
just...
Go ahead.
I just on that point, do you see what's funny there about what you just said? Like, even with the child that's stuck in your head is the one that looks the whitest with the blue eyes.
It's not the fact that he has blue eyes. It's just that... He was so distinctive, particularly that child was so distinctive, I was like, wow, I could almost see his soul, if that makes sense. But sorry, carry on.
I was just saying, in general, people seem to have this idea that, I guess, the fairer the person, like the more beautiful they are, the more memorable they become. Like even within our own cultures, like I've heard people who like have a child who's, you know, slightly darker than their siblings, for example, and it's like, oh, poor kid, you know, like why is he the darker one? Or like in Asian communities where they use the Fair and Lovely creams. To make their skin whiter, but yeah, it's a secondary point.
That's fine. Well, thanks for ripping me. I feel better now.
you're welcome. I hope this was live.
I can cut this out now. I'm editing this. No, carry on.
But I just wanted to make a point in regards to like what you both said about, you know, refugees and like the swarm of statements and whatnot. So, you know, a statement that's really bothered me that I've heard quite often here in New York City, you know, working in corporate America, is just like, there's another bombing that happened. Oh, but it's normal there, or it happens there. That's it's kind of their life, right? I'm very confrontational. I always mention that, and I've gotten into a lot of heated discussions when that was being said. You know, it's just like, no, it's actually not a normal thing. You know, even in Pakistan, where my family's from. You know, when speaking to my dad about how life was in Pakistan before, he's like, "We never had this before. This is like a new phenomenon. Like, this never happened in Pakistan. And now you have a lot of like these killings and these bombings targeting specific people. So like it hit a nerve for me. I don't know how you would deal with that, because I'm pretty sure you also hear that on your end. Or if you don't, and if you do, I just want to know how you handle that situation."
What we have to remember is that in the case of Iraq, pre-2003, there was not a single car bombing in the country. It was only after the US invasion did those attacks start to happen. There were like some assassinations attempts and things like that, but that's usually against political figures. There was corruption by the brutal regime. But when it comes to like widespread terrorism, that came in after the US invasion. So it was there was a cause and an effect. And what we need to remember is that, yeah, as bad as like 9/11 is, and we talk about it all the time, because of how much devastation it's caused people's lives, what we have to remember is that, you know, when a car bomb happens in Iraq and one of those other car bombs that you mentioned, for that person whose family who died, that is his 9/11. Like it's happening for each of these individuals. That is for them what it is. And it's happening so often that it isn't just a number. It's someone's brother that's died. It's someone's sister that's died. And I tell you, like, something that really frustrates me the most, and I've written a piece about this recently, so feel free, anyone who wants to read it, is when you saw the insurrection happen in the US, and journalists across the board, they jumped out and they said, "This isn't America. This looks like it's the Middle East. This isn't what I'm representing America." Or Wolf Blitzer, who's the CNN, he posted a picture of U.S. soldiers on the corner of all the streets in D.C. He says, "This isn't downtown Baghdad. This isn't Mosul. This isn't Fallujah. This is Washington, D.C. And actually, no, like, these are people who their lives aren't defined by war. It's not a comparison. They're suffering just as much as you feel like you've suffered. And it's quite a complex issue when it comes to trying to compare those soldiers to US soldiers in Iraq. At least the soldiers in the US, they speak English, they look white, they look like you, they're there to protect you. In Iraq, they had permission to like break down a door and walk in. And I just want to make a point. Like, I don't know if you guys have seen this. I've spoken to Nuri about it before, actually. There was this game called 6 Days in Fallujah that's supposed to be coming out. And this is where media really plays a point. So that is part of that whole dehumanization I was talking about, where you're playing a game literally fighting the war in Fallujah, where your role is to break down Iraqi people's homes and clear the areas of terrorists. And you see within the trailer, you can see a quivering innocent Iraqi family. And the history of that violence is quite of the Fallujah battle. It's quite brutal. Like, there were potential war crimes that were committed. The use of white phosphorus, the use, the prevention of young men from leaving the city. There was multiple issues going on in that time. And then to make a game about it, that's where the media plays. You're going to be playing a character where it now feels more normal for you to go and attack somebody else. So you know what's complicated is if you see like the U.S. drone program, for example, it's almost become like a game. There are pilots who are living in Texas, dropping bombs in Iraq and Yemen and wherever it is. So you have really detached yourself. So this is that. It's, when you say dehumanization, it's become very complicated. He'll drop the bombs in Iraq, kill a bunch of people, and then be able to tuck his kids in at night at home. It's quite a dangerous thought to think.
On that note, I think one of the most profound, I don't know what the word to use, profound, incredible, inspiring, heartbreaking experiences that you kind of relayed to me and written about was the bombing in Baghdad. I believe it was, I want to say 3 to 5 years ago, where the mall was in Karada, right, was bombed, and about 250 people were killed, which was absolutely, you know, unbelievable. I remember hearing about it, and you know, lots of people in our community were I guess like really heartbroken about it, because you know, especially within the Iraqi community. But you were there, you saw it firsthand. I mean, I just kind of like wanted to speak to you about your experiences, and you know, what exactly happened and the aftermath and how did it affect you as well.
Yeah, that was quite a difficult experience for me. It was the main Karada street, which for those who don't know is one of the main shopping districts in Baghdad, and there's a bunch of restaurants there and like, you know, street food, and it's just kind of like where life is. And this was a couple of days before Eid, so after iftar in Ramadan, people were going out there to, you know, celebrate. It's the last few days of Ramadan, buying gifts for people, enjoying the last meal out, maybe thinking about getting suhoor. And it had been relatively safe. The city had been quiet, not that many car bombs. And I was on my way home, and I don't know, I want to say 400 yards or so ahead of me, there was the big explosion that happened. And the number of people that died in that was the single highest number since the 2003 in an individual incident since the 2003 invasion. And they don't know, they still don't know what the estimates are, over 300. But what's really one of the things that's really distressing about what happened there is that people didn't actually die from the individual, from the actual bomb, because they're not that powerful when you think about the actual explosion. What they ended up dying from was the fact that the mall didn't have fire exits. The cladding that they used as well was the same type of cladding that resulted in the Grenfell fire. And it's a bunch of things that, yes, we need to stand up against the terrorism, but also there was a lot of government inadequacies there that allowed for more than 300 people to die. And so that really like resonated with me, and I still, for months on end, I would get flashbacks. Or if I heard something on the street, someone closing a door, I would jump, or check. Even to this day, if I hear something or a car like screech by or something, it like brings back those triggers. And it just became weird. Like when I went back to London, and I was just like, this isn't normal. How is everyone living a life and excited and smiling and everything when I've just seen 300 dead faces, kind of thing? or people, some faces you couldn't even make out. That's how bad it was. And it just became this thing where I felt like I needed to do more. And that's where I kind of started to really shift into what I was doing. And just as how we speak out against the stuff that the government with Grenfell, we need to be speaking about the Iraqi government and all the inadequacies that happened there, and the countries that allowed for those cladding to be sold, because there are plenty of buildings out there. And I remember actually one of the coolest things that I people that I met was an architect in New York who was telling me about the importance of urban design, and I'd never really thought about it before. And it's all to do with how streets are designed to prevent the attack of a terrorist attack. And Washington, D.C. is a prime example. We don't notice this when we walk there, when you walk around D.C. But when after I spoke to this architect, I really look how wide the sidewalks are and where they've put the plants, or where they've put certain, like, what looks like a monument, but it's actually a concrete barrier. It's these little things that really make you think, wow, like, that you can actually make a difference to prevent anything from happening. That's why even if there was, God forbid, something to happen in DC, the repercussions would be minimal. But when you look at Karada, and you've been to Karada, you've got people on the streets, the sidewalks are tiny, they allow shops to go onto the sidewalks, all those different things.
You mentioned Grenfell, and it's so interesting, because I feel like when you have a connection with a place, and it sounds really horrible to say, but I guess the pain is different, is what I'm trying to say. So, for example, with Grenfell, I grew up, I spent the first 17 years of my life about a 5-minute walk away from Grenfell, in a tower block, which was also cladded. And I remember when we were moving, when we left the building, they were putting up the same flammable cladding on the building. And we lived actually on the 20th floor, right at the end. So the first time I saw Grenfell, which was the day afterwards, I couldn't sleep the whole night, because I was just thinking, you know, that could have easily been us. And I guess being able to relate to the people that were killed in that environment is what kind of, I guess, hurt me the most. So I guess what I wanted to ask you was that, as an Iraqi yourself, who lives outside Iraq and has kind of, I guess, returned to Iraq and now works to Iraq, how does it make you feel to see your country in such a state? Where these things are allowed to happen, and so many people suffer. How do you process your pain in that way?
There's a number of issues that go there. Firstly, it's a massive amount of sadness and stress. Like, family members who have been affected, friends who have been affected. It is quite distressing. But then there's also the element of survivor's guilt that is there as well. Why am I the one that was born in the UK? Like, why was I the lucky one whose parents were able to flee earlier on? Whereas my literal cousins are out there and, you know, going through the pains and struggles and fears and all those different issues. So there is that as well. And I think how I am able to process it is... by using it as a way to make me want to do more, to really try to make that change. And I feel that's where the storytelling comes in, to try to make the difference. And it's understandable that, like you said, you know, you grew up around Grenfell, so you're going to be affected more by that. But it's one of the things that we need to remember, that as humans, we are supposed to be caring creatures. That's what makes us different to other animals. And unfortunately, the way society is today is that you only really care about yourself. So, for example, when it comes to something like COVID, a lot of people don't care about it because they haven't had someone pass away. Like, oh, my parents are fine, my grandparents are fine, like, no one, I don't know anyone that's died, so therefore I'm going to continue being a crazy person and become a super spreader. But the reality is that other people who have different immune systems suffer and die. We should be caring about all of them, just as we should be caring about Iraqis if you're not Iraqi, or what's happening in Tibet and Yemen and Palestine and wherever.
You've written kind of a few articles that kind of unearth, I guess, different glimpses into the art world in Iraq, be it music or whatever. So I guess what I wanted to ask you was, we know that post 2003 Iraq has been suffering from terrorism, car bombs, etc. But in terms of, like, in your opinion, how has art suffered in Iraq post 2003, or has it at all?
Yeah, I think this is a topic I talk about a lot, actually. It's quite interesting because usually in places of oppression, art really kind of flourishes because it becomes a way to express yourself, right? So if you look at 1970s New York City, for example, where did hip-hop arise from? So hip-hop is the b-boy dancing, the music, the rap game even, and graffiti art. That came from New York City in the 1970s, where people were living in the projects, which were getting burned down, and it came from a place of oppression. And so when, for example, the blackouts happened, the famous blackouts in New York, what did those hip-hop artists do? They went to steal, like, DJ sets and vinyls and things like that so that they can make more music because they couldn't afford it. So some of the most famous DJs that we know now and producers and things, that's where they came from. They actually stole something because they've been priced out of buying a $1,000 set. And so it really confuses me when it comes to Iraq, where I guess art has really taken a massive hit when it comes to coming out of the actual country. There's some beautiful stuff coming out there, don't get me wrong, even some films coming out there. So I've got a friend, anyone who wants to look him up, Mohammed Hial, and another one, Ali Rahimi, who have produced some great films from this country. But it's just never been as profound as when you've seen oppression in other places, and it's confused me why. And I think part of the reason is there's this real struggle to even survive, so even to, like, make bread on the table, which then, so art can come from a place of privilege. And then the other thing is, and, like, I don't like to get into, like, religion too much, but it's partly linked to the rise of conservative Islam in the country. And I don't mean, like, Islamists and terrorists or anything like that. I'm talking about
ways of thinking.
Conservative ways of thinking, where you're more scared about the afterlife and things like that, and how you have to be praying all night and reading, like, Quran all day long. That art really takes a backdrop. And if you look at that, if you compare it to the Dark Ages in Europe, and they're called the Dark Ages because nothing came out of that. You can't, like, if I asked you to give me one piece of art that came out of the Dark Age, you can't remember. It was only until the Renaissance came along, which ironically was because of Islam, when, like, the guitar and things like that came into Spain, that Europe woke up and realized the beauty of art. But people were so focused on religion that nobody wrote a book. Few people wrote a book, few people produced anything worth of art. Even the art that was created was very dark and sinister or religious based, and that exists. Like, look at the mullahs in Iraq, reciting their latmiyas, millions of them. They're all spreading out there, but when it comes to other things, they don't exist, and it's unfortunate. But I think, like, there's a point that I do want to make, that when there is art that's coming out, there is this focus on negative imagery, and it will be a focus on war and a focus on violence. And yes, I get it that it's partly because that's what they know and understand. But I think partly because the West believes in war porn. When it comes to the Oscars, you've got some brilliant films that come out. So, for example, Anthony Hopkins just recently won something for The Father, which is a story about dementia, which is a beautiful human narrative, where humans suffer from this all the time. My grandmother, who lived in Baghdad, had that same problem where she was suffering from dementia in a very similar way. But the stories that the West loves and will nominate for an Oscar when it comes out of the Middle East is something negative. So the last Arab film that was nominated for Best Foreign Feature was Capernaum. I don't know if you saw it. Phenomenally shot. A great film. But it was about, like, poverty and racism in the Middle East and the migrant workers' rights and things like that, which is a very, very important topic. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying that when the West does look at the Middle East, they only look at the negative side to almost make themselves feel better about what they do. So that's why I think when Arab artists are making something and aspiring to reach the Oscars and Hollywood and things like that, the idea is, let's make a film about war. So like my friend produced a film about a terrorist sniper, for example, and another guy's about someone living in ISIS and things like that. And it's just become this thing where that's where people feel like the West, whereas something that's universal like dementia does relate to Iraq, but people won't care if there's a film about dementia in Iraq as much as they would if it's come out of the West.
I think that's definitely one obsession of mine. And we've had this discussion. We've had discussions as well on the podcast a lot when it comes to, for example, Muslim storytelling. And I guess this kind of, you know, can relate to what you're saying, is that we don't. I would just like to see, like you said, interesting stories. So, for example, let's say a film about dementia, but it happens to be set in Iraq. Or a film about anything else, but it happens to be set in Iraq. That something tackling very, human values and stories that we can all relate to. But instead of setting it in Wisconsin for the thousandth time, or you know, a Midwestern state, set it in Iraq, or set it in one of these Midwestern countries. I don't know if it's cheap. Maybe it's probably cheap in Iraq, bro. I think that is very important. When it comes to storytelling, and I guess kind of realigning our perspectives on art and on expression. And I think one thing you said, which made me think a lot, was that, you know, art does sometimes come from a place of privilege. So yeah, in America, for example, right now, art has flourished in this post-Trump era, especially when it comes to filmmaking, and I guess all forms of art, because I guess people are in some sort of pain, but like you said, they're also in a place of privilege where they can make films. You know, they don't have to worry about putting food on the table or, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think that's a very interesting point as well.
I don't know if you saw the government in the UK, because of COVID, art took a hit globally, because there was less grants going around and less like funding, and you know, people were staying at home, so no more concerts happening, etc. So art really took a hit. And so the government, I remember they put out a picture of a ballet dancer. I think it was a ballet dancer. And by chance, her name was Fatima. And it was like, Fatima retrained and is now an accountant. You can be anything kind of thing. And it's kind of like that, like it took where art really took a backdrop. When as soon as there was like a little bit of suffering in the UK, suddenly art took a real back footing. Yeah.
I was going to speak about that whole movement in America from like the Black Lives Matter and like the shootings and everything like that, and the amount of art that came out of it. As you know, like the whole Black Lives Matter movement that happened all across the U.S. I know places like in Columbus, Ohio, places in New York City, graffiti artists would just go paint on walls now, to the point where like the museums. We're like, we need to keep this art because this art is from an era of like change, of like resistance, right? And so these museums are now coming in and they want to get this art in the museum because they want to capture this time. And I was also pondering on the fact that you mentioned how in Iraq, like the art is kind of in like a cat and mouse game a little bit. A lot of the, not just Iraqi art, but the Arab art in general, like the Palestinian art, the Iraqi art, the Pakistani art. The most amazing art pieces I've seen from that area are from people who came here and were doing the art here about the time there. Which is very interesting because I haven't seen, I mean, I'm pretty sure there are, but like in Iraq, I haven't seen, when I was there, I made a good effort to see the art around, and you see beautiful graffiti on the walls everywhere, but nothing like museum type or anything like that. It's all being done here. So which is kind of like, are we taking the talent out from there? Or is it because of the privilege that you were mentioning that now that you come here, although it's still a struggle, you now have the utensils you need to make that art? You know, it's a very interesting thing that came across my head.
Yeah, I think that as in obviously now that you're out of the struggle to survive mode, you can explore your like creative like blood a lot more. And I think even there's a risk of throwing it into museums where you have this admissions fee and things like that. You're then narrowing art once more into like the very privileged class. And sometimes I think what it is that anything that let's say like an Iraqi artist does, people like promote just because he's in the West and it's easier to get access to that person who's living in the West. There might be some great artists doing very similar things living in Baghdad, but because it's a lot harder to access, things like even getting them a visa into the country. I know people who are excellent filmmakers. I wrote a piece about a friend of mine about visas once, about how what it's like to travel with an unwanted passport for Vice. And one of my friends is who I mentioned earlier, actually, is a filmmaker. He was denied a visa to go to Australia for to win an award. To win a filmmaking award was denied, and his response was to me, and I still remember this, and it's in the quote. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but he used an expletive. Was like, when the Australians came into my country, did they ask for a visa when they invaded Iraq? So that's just like an interesting thing. But yeah, you're right. Like, I think as soon as you get into the West, you have access to a lot more stuff to be able. And it's training and workshops and things. Like, yes, you've said you're a self-trained actor, but actually you have access to YouTube, good YouTube to watch, like those masterclass videos. You've got a good grasp of the language, so automatically there's that. You've got access to books, you can watch a bunch of films. You have such an opportunity for us. So even when we do say we're self-taught or self-trained, there is a huge other element that's provided to us that others don't really have access to.
Winding down, I want you to tell us about your venture into filmmaking, because like I said in the beginning, you're very multifaceted, mashallah. You're not just a journalist, not just a great guy, but you're also a filmmaker. So I guess, briefly, how did that kind of, I'm guessing it comes from your strive to tell stories, but where did in particular your journey with filmmaking start? How did it start, and why did you decide to take that jump?
Yeah, so... I think firstly, when it comes to representation in media, I think it's really important. Like, to grow up as an Iraqi in the West, there's been such almost no representation of me or someone like me on TV. There's been some, like, maybe brown Muslims, there've been some like Arabs here and there, but when it comes to Iraq, all you see is negativity. Like, quite literally, it's either war or violence. And I remember one of the shows that I loved, I think it's Nuri's favorite show, is Lost.
Like
watching that when I was young, like, honestly, what's the other show you keep banging on about? No.
Best show ever. Sorry, Karen. I know you're going to go with this, though.
Yeah, it's because I've spoken to you about it before. But one of the only there's a character on there, and this is the only character on TV that I can remember is Iraqi, unless they're playing Saddam or someone like that, was a guy called Syed, if you guys remember him. Firstly, played by a British Indian actor, not even an Arab actor. And secondly, his character was a former torturer under the Saddam regime. So even then, it's got this like character who's almost like a negative connotation to him. And it's just became this thing where, you know what, we need to include more of our people like us. And, you know, we've got shows like Rami, for example, where people say, oh, it's great that you've got an Arab audience. But still, again, even in that situation, it's Egyptian Arabs, or I think a couple of Yemenis and a couple of just the Palestinians. And so I think when it comes to what Iraqis have, it's like very poor. So that's like part of the reason why I was like, you know what, this needs to change. That's one thing that needs to happen. And secondly, I do see there's I know you say it's multifaceted, but I think it's there's a huge crossover between journalism, storytelling, and in terms of film. Especially when it comes towards like making documentaries and things like that. And now it's really hard to like blur the lines. And I was watching Ken Burns once, he made a speech where he was saying how now people are way more fascinated by the real world because it's so much more interesting than some of the narratives that are coming out there. Like as much, even I remember the writers of like House of Cards used to say, we can't keep up with what Trump is doing because it's even more shocking than our plot twists kind of thing. So it became this thing where documentaries are, and that's why you see places like Netflix and Hulu and HBO are all throwing out more documentaries than we've ever seen before. So I think that now there's the blurred lines between what is just like a pure journalist and what's a storyteller. And for me, it kind of just became a natural progression. I've always loved film. I've always been like engaged with film, and it was just—it's been a thing that I used to watch and like hope that it was something I could do, or I almost saw it as something unattainable. To be honest with you, like you see the Oscars and you see this and you see that, and it's such a grand thing. It's such a grand thing that it's like who's gonna? But then you've got people like Daniel Kula who grew up not too far from where I grew up and is now the first Black British artist to win an Oscar, for example. So yeah, that's kind of where it triggered. And I guess I got involved in like some little things here and there, like as a producer in a short film, as a this, as that, and then like doing some documentaries. And then I came up with an idea for a story, which I can't share on here, but
look forward to seeing it.
Like going
to
be made.
Yeah, look forward to seeing it. As a final question, just kind of wrapping up. I think this podcast is generally about spirituality and how one spirituality kind of mixes with their art or their love of art. Spirituality means different things to different people. So to you, your craft and your art, your filmmaking, your journalism, your desire to tell stories, what role does that play with your spirituality, and how does your spirituality impact it, and vice versa?
I think my experiences growing up, and like all those different stories you hear when it comes to like in Islam and religion and things like that, have all pointed towards trying to make a positive change in the world. For me, that was the spirituality was, it comes from like the want to make change. I think for my own individual spirituality, like when you see something created and something that's beautiful, it does leave you with a sense of awe in general. Even if it's me watching someone else's film, or if I've like made my own thing and like loving your own work, I think is really important, because it inspires you to keep going more and more. It doesn't mean that you're perfect at what you're doing, but it just inspires you to even like strive for that perfection. And I guess that's what our life is. Like that's what we always get taught in Islam, is to strive for that perfection, to make that change. And I guess that's really where the spirituality comes from.
Beautiful. Thank you, Ahmed. Thank you so much. I want to appreciate you for all your fantastic work, and inshallah, hopefully I'll see you again soon. At some point, you said I think we're going to link up at some point in the future. You keep changing your travel plans, so finalize your travel plans and hopefully we'll meet up. I guess just before we let you go, where can people find you, where can people follow you, and where can they find your work?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. My username is Twaiji, so Twaiji. I've also got a website, but I don't think anybody checks it out. That's my first
I was checking it out.
AhmedTwage.com.
You were checking it out because you're the research on the guest.
I was checking it out. It was pretty impressive.
All right, bro. Ahmed, I'll see you soon. Thanks. Take care.
All right. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thanks, Ahmed, for that wonderfully inspiring conversation. We hope to have you here again soon. Please do not forget to subscribe to us on all platforms. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and of course, YouTube. Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really does help out the channel. And hit that notification bell so you are made aware of whenever we launch a new episode, which is every single Sunday, inshallah. We'll see you next week here over at 786 Boulevard.